In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the current state of and activities of extremist groups, political extremist groups in America, particularly groups on the right, the extreme right of the political spectrum. And our guest for the program is Chip Burleigh. He is a senior analyst at Political Research Associates, which is based in Massachusetts, a group that's been around since 1981, doing research, putting out publications on the right in American politics, something that's often used by activists and journalists and other people that are concerned about the right in American politics. He has written widely on the topic, publications of the Political Research Associates, but also his work as a freelancer have appeared in many, many different publications, the New York Times, Mother Jones, The Nation, The Progressive, Boston Phoenix, many, many others. He's also been widely interviewed and has appeared on programs like Nightline and The Today Show, as well as All Things Considered and Fresh Air and other programs on public radio. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, your questions and comments are certainly welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL, that's the number for Champaign-Urbana, and also toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Anyone's welcome to call in, make questions, comments. All we ask of people is just try to be brief, and we just ask that so we can accommodate as many different callers as possible and keep things moving along. But certainly, anyone's welcome in joining the conversation. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Burleigh, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
I guess the reason that we started thinking about wanting to touch bases on this topic was indeed the approaching execution of Timothy McVeigh. And perhaps we could start by talking just a little bit about him, and maybe not so much him specifically, but place him in context and talk about where it is he comes from, ideologically speaking.
Well, there's a lot of confusion about that because Mr. McVeigh actually is an American neo-Nazi who in part blew up the federal building, as he states, to punish the government. But like most terrorists, he was trying to attract another audience, and that was the militia movement. And the militia movement was not as ideologically rigid or violent as Mr. McVeigh is a neo-Nazi. And so the dynamic there was to try and get more people in the militia movement to move over to join the revolutionary or insurgent neo-Nazi movement. And that's a dynamic that happens throughout history, where you have people who engage in acts of terrorism to try and move a less volatile, less ideological group of people towards insurgency. Mm.
Just then to talk, we maybe go back to Tim McVeigh in a second, but to talk about what's happening with the militia movement. I've just was recently looking at a report that I'm sure you have seen by an organization that has some of the same interests as yours. That's the Southern Poverty Law Center. Mm-hmm. And they have now put out some figures on patriot groups or militia groups, and note that since the high point of membership in these groups, which was, I guess, 1996, there has been quite a significant decline, so that we were talking about 858 groups in 96 and now 194. Assuming that you think that that's probably at least the trend is on target, if not the specific numbers.
I think it's right.
You think that's right. What exactly has happened there, and what? Why did we see the spike those few years ago, 7 years ago or so, and why is it that now at this point there has been this decline in membership of these groups?
Well, I think actually it wasn't a spike that was dramatic around those years. What you had was a steady growth from about 1990 onwards, mm-hmm. with the Patriot Movement being the broader movement of people in America who are conservative to right-wing, that believe the government is controlled by secret elites and manipulated by secret forces, and presume that there's about to be some kind of tyranny imposed by these government stooges, whether that's martial law or some kind of political repression. That's what I called the Patriot Movement. And there's probably close to 5 million Americans who believe that kind of rhetoric. Out of that spun in the mid-90s, or actually early 1992, 93, you saw the development of the militia movement, which was simply the armed wing of the Patriot Movement. And so you had a movement that was growing, then you had the bombing, and there was basically, I don't know whether it was through momentum or the publicity attracted people, there was another year or so of growth. But since then, the militia movement has declined rapidly, and there's a lot of reasons that are given for that. One is that a lot of people in the militia movement were pretty shocked by the bombing, because they were vigilantes, not in their own description but mine, but they were vigilantes in a defensive kind of sense, and this was an act of revolutionary aggression or insurgent aggression, which I think scared a lot of them and turned them off, and they were horrified. But also there were other factors. I mean, we had an approaching millennium that wound up a lot of people around survivalism, which helped boost the militia movement, and then when nothing happened, it helped undercut them. There was infighting. There were a lot of splits in the militia movement. And movements do this all the time. It's pretty classic sociology. You have groups of people with grievances. They form these movements, and these social movements grow to a certain point, and then either they institutionalize, like the women's movement did, or they basically drop off and can't sustain the energy. Mm.
But I suppose that you would counsel people not to then go from looking at these numbers and looking at the fact that that membership in these militia groups has declined. One shouldn't take that for a decline in support for the kind of ideological underpinning of these groups.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's important to look back throughout U.S. history and see that right-wing populist groups have formed throughout U.S. history, going all the way back to the colonial period with Bacon's Rebellion, and then after the Revolution, the Shays Rebellion, and then the Ku Klux Klan was a similar kind of group, the Minutemen in the 1960s, 1970s, so that basically this is a kind of event that happens periodically throughout U.S. history. And in fact, I just co-wrote a book cleverly called Right-Wing Populism in America that talks about how actually ordinary this kind of event is, but how dangerous it is because it basically mobilizes all of these angry, mostly white men in the middle who rail against these secret elites up above and often incorporate old anti-Jewish canards into that about Jewish banking conspiracies. But what they tend to do is they stomp on people down below them, and these movements tend to devolve into movements that promote white supremacy or anti-Semitism. And I think a lot of people in the militia movement don't know that, or at least they're not conscious of it. But a lot of their arguments are rooted in these old white supremacist legal arguments that go back before the Civil War with people like Calhoun, and old anti-Semitic conspiracy theories about, you know, secret control by Jewish elites.
Mm-hmm. And maybe one further point that we have a caller I get right to. Then also, though, one thing that apparently has happened as membership in these militia groups has declined, some of these people perhaps have just given up and gone home, but some numbers of them have gone on to more extreme right-wing groups.
I think that's true. I think a small number looked at what happened and decided to move on into more violent and more ideologically right groups. Others went underground and are simply biding their time because they expect government repression to happen at some point. And still others faded back into the Patriot Movement. So although they've left the militia movement, they aren't out of the movement per se. They just simply left the armed wing of it. So it's very complicated, and I think we don't know as much as we should about this movement because it was something that happened very quickly and then began to fade, and there's a lot of confusion and suspicion among the militia people themselves about what the movement represented, and these debates helped split it, and that was one of the reasons that some folks made choices to either move back towards electoral reform or move into a more insurgent kind of political movement.
This morning in this hour of Focus 580, we're talking with Chip Burleigh. He's senior analyst with Political Research Associates. This is an organization that's been around since 1981. They do research. They put out publications tracking and exploring and writing about extremist political groups in the United States. And as he mentioned, if you're interested in this particular topic, you might look for a book which he co-authored, was published last year, which is titled Right-Wing Populism in America, Too Close for Comfort, which he wrote with Matthew Lyons and is published by Guilford and should be available if you want to go out and take a look at it. And questions here are welcome. We have folks ready to go here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll go first person in line, Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, hi.
Yes.
Just as an aside before I ask my questions, I'm not sure if it's fair to characterize Shay's rebellion as right-wing populism. I'm not too familiar on the history of that, but from what I know, it doesn't sound like something that could be defined as a right-wing populist movement, or certainly not analogous to what's going on now. But that aside, I think it's a curious thing that left-wing dissidents get so much more attention than right-wing, than, you know, the millions of right-wing populists that you're talking about. And I wonder if this isn't because these right-wing, so-called right-wing populists basically reflect dominant mainstream values, except for the fact that they don't believe that only the state should have the means to violently oppose what they deem criminal acts. So, you know, you find libertarian aspects to right-wing, you find Christian fundamentalist aspects to right-wing, but I don't see in any of these basic values any sharp differences between the dominant corporate Republican and even democratic values that characterize the mainstream of our political system. I just think that it's the means that come into question, that elites get scared when somebody else wants to use violence other than them. And it's particularly ironic considering that McVeigh learned his trade in the U.S. Army in this kind of state-sponsored terrorism that we visited on the Middle East at that time. And, you know, sort of related to that is the, you know, I know you've done some writing on the ADL and their obsession with, you know, with left-wing, supposed left-wing, extremists. Rather than right-wing. Over the years, I've seen a real shift in the ADL from a concern from right-wing populism, so-called right-wing populism, to so-called left-wing anti-Semitism and you know, Muslim terrorists and so on and so forth. So I was just wondering if you could comment on a few of these concerns.
I think the problem is that what Matt and I are trying to do is rethink how the term extremism is used. The very term extremism, I think, is wrong because it posits that the center is always good and then there are these troublemakers on the left and right, and it lumps them together as if they're trying to accomplish the same thing. And it also fails to make a distinction between methodology, so that people who are nonviolent and using the electoral system are lumped in the same category with people who bomb buildings. And I think that's part of the problem, is the very language we use. So what we're trying to explain is that not everyone who is a dissident is on some sort of slippery slope towards criminal behavior. So that the first thing is to recognize that being a dissident doesn't necessarily place you in some suspect category. But once you are a dissident and you're articulating a set of policies, then those policies need to be inspected. And if you look at right-wing populist movements throughout U.S. history, and I would include as a proto-form both the Bacon's Rebellion and Shays' Rebellion, although I don't think you really have a true right-wing populism movement until the Klan. But, you know, you have this kind of model of suspicion of the government, which turns into a kind of revolt against any kind of elite, which then has, is unattached from the legitimacy of any of the complaints that start out. And I would disagree with one thing you said. I think there's a real difference with the militia movement and mainstream America. Primarily, though, is because they're anti-globalist, and both the Democrats and the Republicans are very much involved in spreading, you know, the power of corporate rule over the globe. That's their version of globalization. I disagree with it. But the militia movement disagrees with it, too. But that doesn't mean that my critique of globalization on behalf of corporations is the same critique as the militia movement. The militia movement critique is awash with paranoid claims about...
But couldn't you also say that the whole Cold War was an example of this kind of paranoid conspiracy thinking made very respectable by intellectual elites? And
I'll agree with you on that part. I'll agree that what you have is a kind of mirror. The philosopher René Girard calls it mimetic scapegoating, that the government then looks at dissident movements using that same paranoid lens and presumes that all dissident movements are a dire threat to the state, and then engages in political repression and spinning a kind of propaganda model which demonizes all dissent as subversion. So I'm not saying that the government is right to do this. I'm saying that just because the government does this doesn't mean that there are no differentiations in dissident movements. So I'm saying that the militia movement is wrong and the government is wrong. And in fact, what we get in 1996 from a Democratic administration is this same effect. After the militia movement was sort of highlighted in the press, the Oklahoma City bombing is blamed on the militia movement, and that, along with the claim that TWA Flight 800 had been bombed by a terrorist, we passed legislation in 1996 that's very repressive. And both claims, that the militia movement bombed the federal building and that Flight TWA 800 had been brought down by a terrorist bomb, were false. They were just scapegoating kind of use in the political system to pass a repressive law. So I'm going to agree that a lot of the back and forth that happens is very negative. But just because the government is wrong to engage in repressive activity towards dissidents doesn't mean the dissidents are right.
Yeah, no, of course I don't believe that they're right, especially in their violent means, and I don't agree with their basic analysis of what's wrong either with the way government does operate.
Their point of view is that secret elites have penetrated the government and stolen America from the people. Do you agree with that?
No, of course. No, I'm not saying that I do. I'm just saying that I increasingly understand that it's not that these dissident groups are not so much the problem, but a reflection of a much larger problem in terms of the people who have the real power and the real weapons.
Oh, there we would agree. Absolutely, I agree.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.
All right, well, we have other callers. Let's go to Chicago next, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes.
I have two questions. One, I understand women are becoming more active in this extremist movement. Is that true?
To a certain extent, yes.
Yeah, that's strange because most of these extremist groups look at women as more or less broodmares. They want them to populate the area.
That's simply not true. That's a very old sociology that's been discredited. The very concept that all extremist movements view women a particular way is just wrong.
Well, a lot of them do, though. A lot of them figure that women are only good.
Name one group. Pick one group to illustrate your claim.
Well, the Aryan Nation, for instance.
Aryan Nations had lots of women activity. They had senior training sessions for women. I'm not going to disagree that there's an overwhelmingly white male aspect, straight white male aspect, to groups like Aryan Nations. But in the militia movement, one of the early leaders was Linda Thompson, a woman.
Well, I don't know that much about the militia movement. I just know that the Aryan Nation... Because one of the other things I wanted to know is it true that they're going now to something called leaderless resistance? In other words, if you want to... blow up the FBI building, or if you want to blow up a black church, don't go talk about it, just go do it.
Well, you know, it's a problem. In terms of revolutionary right activity,
There is a theory that, two theories, one is leaderless resistance and one is the underground cell structure, both of which basically argue that instead of having large groups with national meetings and people interacting, that individuals who are going to take acts of armed violence against the government need to either just do it on their own, and that's leaderless resistance, or form cells, which is a cell structure. None of this is new. This comes out of revolutionary theory of both the left and right for centuries.
Well, as a matter of fact, I believe
Louis Beam basically rearticulated it in recent times and promoted it after the government started going after some of these right-wing groups. So yes, leaderless resistance and cells are the way that a lot of groups that are planning violence have gone. That's clear, and I would argue that that's what McVeigh was in. He certainly was not leaderless resistance. He was in a group, a cell of people. We know four of them, the four TAs who were given immunity, I think, incorrectly, Mr. Nichols and Mr. McVeigh. And there were probably others, as the government well knows, and the jury in the Nichols case decided that there were clearly other people involved.
I have one more thing, and then I'll let someone else talk. When you have a situation like you had after the O.J. Simpson trial or after the Cincinnati riots, do you see an increase in these groups? Membership?
I really don't know. I think it's too hard to track because of the lag time in doing the research. I just don't know.
I see. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And we'll go on to another caller here, Belgium, line number two. Hello.
Hello. It seems to me that these people have a very strong right to have a suspicion of their government when you look at what we have done historically to native peoples, blacks, our environment. Everything. I mean, every time you turn around, the government has stepped on somebody's rights.
Never their own, sir.
Well,
is that because of institutional racism, or is that because of secret Jewish banking elites?
I'm not saying anything about any kind of Jewish banking elite, sir. What I'm pointing out is that our government traditionally steps on minorities in any way, shape, or form.
And I'm arguing
if there's somebody
how you perceive that is very important. Don't you see a difference between understanding that the government and other institutional forces in America have repressed various groups, minorities and others, you know, blacks, women, Native Americans, whatever, or thinking that a secret elite has stolen the government and that's why this happens, which is the militia argument.
No, I'm not, sir, I tend to disagree with you sometimes in that I don't think somebody like Mr. McVeigh, what he did was horrid, and he needs to die for it. But, sir, some of the points that he makes out are very true. Look at what they didn't even turn in all the evidence for his case. It makes you wonder, doesn't it?
I'm asking you to be a little more skeptical about just saying anyone who opposes the government for its clear wrongdoing has a point. It's not a point that there's some giant conspiracy, no matter who you allege runs it. It's a difference between an institutional analysis like that of a C. Wright Mills or a G. William Domhoff or a Holly Sklar or a Barbara Ehrenreich, and people who simply look at the government as run by a secret conspiracy. There's no difference between those two views in your mind?
What I'm trying to point out, sir, is that we are our form of government and our form of economy dictates that we have to malign somebody or some group constantly to keep authority. Whether it was the people in 1968 that were protesting the Vietnam War, whether it's the blacks, whether it's the Native American peoples who happen to want to keep their land, whether it's the unrepresented environment that goes on constantly being destroyed by none other than our existing president, sir, it's something that I can see why these people take that point of view. Thank you very much.
All right, Chip. Yeah, any other way you want to?
I agree that the government engages in activities which I think decent citizens should oppose. Obviously, what happened to the Branch Davidians and to the Weaver family was wrong. But what do you make of that? Do you make of that the need to form armed cells and blow up buildings because secret elites run the government? Or do you seek to reform the institutions and point out how deeply embedded some of these forms of oppression and repression are in a society? I don't dispute that the government does things that are wrong. I'm arguing that there is, in fact, a distinction between people who construct that as a paranoid conspiracy theory and people who look at it from an institutional or systemic point of view. There's a very big difference in terms of democratic outcome.
Hmm. Our guest this morning, Chip Berlay, he's senior analyst at Political Research Associates. That's an organization that's been around since 1981 that does research and puts out publications that's used by both activists and journalists and a lot of other people who are interested in the activities of primarily groups on the extreme political right in this country. He has spent over 25 years studying prejudice and conspiracism and authoritarianism. He's investigated far-right hate groups, but also civil liberties violations and police misconduct, has done a lot of writing and speaking. He's been widely interviewed on radio and television. His freelance pieces have appeared in many different publications. And if you're interested in reading some of his writing, you might sample a recent book titled Right-Wing Populism in America, Too Close for Comfort by Chip Berlay and Matthew Lyons, published by Guilford Publications, came out last year. And, of course, questions are welcome here on the program, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just maybe, again, for a second to return to Timothy McVeigh, we talked about the fact that some people within the militia movement were really horrified by what he did, and that was one reason that perhaps people left. But generally, if it's possible to say, when we really look at the extreme right, the paramilitary right, how people regard him and what he did?
Well, I think I want to make a distinction between different sectors of the right. You have the electoral system where you have conservatives and to a large extent, the Republican Party. If you look at right-wing politics in America, it ranges from people involved in the electoral system. And then you have dissident groups like the militias, the patriot movement. The Christian right is a dissident right-wing populist movement. And then you have on the extreme right or the far right, you have insurgent or revolutionary groups like Aryan Nations, like Church of the Creator right there in Illinois, groups that really they seek to overthrow the government and establish some kind of racial state or some other kind of authoritarian state system. And so it really depends where you are. If you're a Nazi, a neo-Nazi in America, many of them applauded what he did. If you're in the militia movement, even if you hate the government because you project on it all these conspiracy theories, or even if your criticism is accurately looking at the government misconduct at Ruby Ridge with the Weaver family or in Waco with the Branch Davidians, you look at McVeigh and you say to yourself one of several things. One is, what he did was wrong because, we would never blow up a building full of innocent people. Or you say, the government blew up the building and McVeigh's just a patsy. And a lot of people, and you can go to the Free Republic website and see it's a ultra-conservative website, and there's a big discussion among people on that website about whether McVeigh is actually a patsy and the government really did it, and this is all a conspiracy to pass repressive laws and to take away guns. So a major narrative in the militia movement is that McVeigh really didn't bomb the federal building. It was all part, or if he did, it was all part of a government plot to bomb its own building to gain sympathy for the government and to pass repressive laws.
Well, what do those people make of the fact that he's said that he did it?
Well, those people would say, and I've read what they say either that's true, he did it, but he was part of a government plot, even if he didn't know it, or they say he's lying, or they say that he's trained by the government, or there was mind control to have him do it, so now he admits doing it because that's part of the mind control plan. There's a lot of conspiracy theories about it. But there's a very central argument in the militia movement right now is that if the government was involved in blowing up the building in order to gain sympathy for the government and give it an upper hand in passing repressive laws and especially taking away guns.
Mm-hmm. And for these people, is the execution of McVeigh a significant event?
Yes and no. I mean, a lot of them don't care either way. Some of them, there are people in the militia movement like anywhere else who oppose the death penalty, but most don't seem to. They most seem to support it. But their argument is that the government shouldn't kill Timothy McVeigh because he's a patsy and that the government is killing him just to cover up what really went on. So in that sense, they're making it an issue.
We have other callers. Let's go to Champaign again, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Great show. I'm surprised by some of the specious calls coming in, but I would like to say there is very good forensic evidence to link Timothy McVeigh to the Oklahoma City bombing.
And, that's for sure.
And people who think there's a conspiracy don't understand what it's like to sift, I think, a bomb site for 20 days looking for material. I mean, if they were going to manufacture a conspiracy, they could certainly do an easier one. What I find interesting is how easily Americans fall into the myth of supporting the rightist beliefs. And I've had many contacts with military people, and I have deep respect for them and the job they do. However, there seems to be a real cliquish mentality in them of right and wrong. And I think it's good that you're talking about this, because otherwise people can become very sheepish in some ways, and until they become a mob. And people who don't take the right seriously should really remember that even here in Illinois up into the 40s, many people were lynched by these same people who are now the militia, without any evidence or legal, you know, maneuvering of any sort. And so I'm very glad to hear you, and please keep up the good work.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, let's continue. We'll go to Crete for another caller here. This is line number four. Hello.
Yeah, one of the main aspects of these right-wing groups, and obviously left-wing groups too, in the 60s, was to force the government to pass oppressive laws in which they could point to as an example of what they mean by the dominant aggressive government. And I think in many ways they have been successful in that area regarding more money for FBI, more money for surveillance, et cetera, et cetera. So in some ways they have won partly their victories on that basis. And the American public is concerned about the lack of privacy and the lack of independence and individuality, which the government in a sense has attempted to foreclose in certain areas. Drugs, for example, is one beautiful example of the overkill of the government, which some people could point to. The other point is the issue of hate crimes. I'm quite concerned about this new fad of states and legal bodies passing things called hate crimes. In almost every case, we already have a law in the book that adequately takes care of criminals who perpetrate such crimes as we define now as hate crimes. We used to call them murder and rape and battery and things like that. And now in this new wave of hysteria, or whatever you want to call it, we have this new concept, basically, called hate crimes. And I would like you to comment on, one, the government's often stupid response to social and economic problems, drugs and militia groups and the oppressive nature of sharpshooters killing women, and the fact that the hate crime syndrome has caught up with reality and rationality.
Well, the first part, I certainly agree that one of the worst things the government can do when it's being basically put in a position by acts of violence is to pass more repressive legislation, because, of course, there's already legislation on the books to deal with acts of criminal violence. So it's a sucker punch, essentially. I mean, the government does the worst possible thing when it responds to dissidency by passing more repressive legislation, because, in fact, it is a self-fulfilling prophecy, just like the worst thing the government can do to Timothy McVeigh is to make him a martyr by putting him to death. And that's separate. I mean, I oppose the death penalty because I think, you know, government should be morally superior to the folks they judge. But if you're just on a strategic level, the worst thing you can do with Timothy McVeigh is execute him, because then he takes on a life larger than his life, where if he rotted in jail, which I certainly agree with the previous caller, he deserves to. There's plenty of evidence that he was involved in that bombing. The larger question of hate crimes is a tough one, because I support limited hate crimes legislation, but I can see that it's being used in a very bad way now, and in a couple of levels. One is with mandatory minimums. One is basically, instead of using hate crimes penalties to send people into diversionary programs where they can, you know, perhaps learn to deal with their aggression and their prejudice, we're simply sending folks to more jail time. That's not right. So I think that
I recognize that there are some real problems with hate crimes legislation, but I would prefer to tinker with them and make them serve a more useful role. But I do think there needs to be a public discussion about how they're being used. And one of the great ironies now is that among hate crimes, one of the fastest growing areas of hate crimes is against gay men and lesbians, but primarily gay men. But what happens is very often young men who are conflicted over their own sexual identity engage in gay bashing to prove to themselves that they're heterosexual. And the worst thing you can do for someone like that is to basically hit them with a triple sentence and send them off into the jail system without realizing what's going to go on there in terms of rape, in terms of not offering them any counseling for them to deal with their sexual identity, whether it's straight or gay. So what you have is the use of hate crimes as an illusion. Instead of using it as a constructive tool, the hate crimes legislation is passed, and we're all supposed to forget that racism, sexism, homophobia, and anti-Semitism are woven into the fabric of America. It exceptionalizes those systems of oppression and scapegoats the people who are caught in criminal acts and lets us off the hook as a society.
I agree. Thank you.
All right. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Talking with Chip Burleigh from Political Research Associates, has spent a long time investigating far-right hate groups, but also writing on subjects including civil liberties violations and police misconduct. He's widely interviewed on radio and television. He's done a lot of writing, papers that are published by Political Research Associates, and they do have a website. You can go there and you can read about their organization and read some of his work. He's also done freelance writing, has appeared in all the major publications around the country. He's the author, co-author of the book Right-Wing Populism in America, Too Close for Comfort, with Matthew Lyons. That book was published last year by Guilford, so that's out there too if you want to take a look at it. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You have talked about, and I know I've read some of your writing on the subject, in where you lay out the landscape of the right and the fact that there are many different groups with different sorts of priorities, although the agendas of these groups often overlap and they find some areas in which they will agree and some areas in which they won't. Is there enough basis for agreement that we might be concerned that there might be major alliances formed so that these kinds of groups really do get together and act in a concerted fashion?
You know, I actually doubt it. I think if that were to happen, it would, of course, be horrific. But there's just no evidence that that's likely to happen in America. And I think one of the problems, of course, is that by looking at the most far-right groups and seeing them as the only threat in this area, we miss the dynamic. And that's one of the things that's really the most important. The dynamic here is one of demonization and then scapegoating and then conspiracy theories that are basically a narrative form of scapegoating and then acts of aggression against the named scapegoats. And this dynamic occurs across the political spectrum. When we see it in the most dramatic and violent form, we recognize it as bad. And certainly what Mr. McVeigh did was terrible, and he's guilty of sin and should rot in jail forever. But, you know, we see this kind of scapegoating in both the Democratic and the Republican Party, too, to gain votes. So it's important to see this dynamic as a dynamic that is basically woven through the fabric of American society. Some groups take it further than others, but it's no good to simply point out to those furthest right groups and say that's what brings racism or sexism or homophobia or anti-Semitism or ableism or any of the other isms which are oppressive into American society. These things are already in American society. The far right groups move in like vultures and try to exploit it and turn the prejudice into acts of discrimination and acts of violence. That's the dynamic that's important.
Hmm. We have another caller. This is Champagne, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. Actually, I'm just calling to get a little clarification.
Mm-hmm.
I listened to the response about hate crimes, and actually I really appreciated the caller putting rape in the category of hate crimes, because in fact it's not and probably really should be. But was the respondent saying that he agreed that there should be hate crime legislation, but he disagreed with sort of the penal system?
In a sense, yes. And what I'm arguing is that I think the basic idea of hate crimes legislation is sound, and even the ACLU has written a very nice study paper saying, you know, this really doesn't violate rights if it's handled properly. What I'm saying is the way that some hate crimes laws are now being pursued and the outcome of them has not been what a lot of groups have looked forward to. And there's now some, especially among gay rights groups like the Audre Lorde Center in New York, are speaking openly against the way hate crimes legislation is used around gay bashing, and actually sticking up for the gay bashers and saying the worst thing you can do for a gay basher is to send them into the criminal justice system for more time. That simply is not constructive. Especially since many people who engage in gay bashing are themselves conflicted over their own sexual identity. So what you're seeing is some of the advocacy groups that first pushed for hate crimes legislation now backing off and saying, wait a minute, the way these are being enforced and the outcomes in terms of simply adding up more and more time as sentences, this is not constructive.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I understand your answer. I think it's sort of I agree with you. It's an interesting dilemma, though, no? Because you don't have to take gay bashing, if in fact rape was a hate crime, listed as a hate crime, which it's not, but clearly it's perpetrated against a group, by a group, which my understanding is sort of the basis of hate crimes, correct?
That it's group-identified violence.
Right?
Well, the target is targeted because of the perception that they belong to a group that is stigmatized in the mind of the attacker.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So I think...
I just wonder, you know, it's not that I so much disagree, but one could say not to send a rapist into the penal system because clearly he's going to get raped.
I'm anguished over this question. It's not one I have a glib answer for. I help support the hate crimes legislation, and now I'm being, you know, yanked at by groups that I've worked with for years saying, you know, this isn't working out the way we thought, and I'm being forced to rethink it. So I'm in anguish over this question. I don't have an easy answer.
And my just last question, or I guess question comment, is you do, however, see when you talk and write about a right-wing militia, you do see that as interrelated, obviously, to hate crimes and to the targeting of specific persons.
I see the dynamic as the same. In other words, that because they tend to construct the world as a paranoid conspiracy theory, or I would say more accurately, an apocalyptic conspiracy theory, they tend to scapegoat groups. Now, right now, they tend to be scapegoating the government as run by secret elites, but the dynamic of scapegoating, the demonization, and, you know, let's take feminists as an example. If you demonize women activists as feminazis, you know, and then you develop a conspiracy theory that they're taking over our schools. The inevitable outcome of that kind of rhetoric is some people will decide, well, let's go beat them up. That's actually pretty easy to predict, and that's a very terrible dynamic. So what I'm arguing is that even if the group that I'm studying hasn't moved into a really horrific phase, the dynamic that they've adopted of demonization, scapegoating, conspiracy theory leads to violence against the scapegoated groups.
Mm-hmm. I guess I would just leave with one thought, and if you want to comment, fine, I'll listen offline. But just that it seems to me that in the ways in which you're identifying groups, it leaves out women in an interesting way. Other groups are, I mean, typically being a woman is not considered so much a stigma. And yet, it certainly, as one caller pointed out, the way in which that caller perceived right-wing militias is women as breeding grounds, and
Yeah, but they don't. That's not accurate. There's a lot of publicity about the militias that's just wrong. Most people in the militia movement are no more or less sexist than the average person at the New York Times.
Uh-huh. Well, that's hardly comforting.
I know.
Okay, thanks so much.
All right, we'll try and get at least one more caller here. This is Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Thank you. While you were speaking about these individuals and these cell groups and others that may be active in their own malicious ways, there are the groups that are doing things conscientiously, such as Physicians for Social Responsibility and SANE against nuclear problems, and those mothers who are against the drunk drivers, and many other groups that could be cited for doing things collectively and conscientiously towards being constructive and bringing about change, rather than those who are have some insidious plot in mind that is deviant and destructive. So I think there's an awakening things and to the common good and getting an ecology of understanding of the situations that prevail, such as we see, can go a long way if they apply themselves with groups that have peaceful intent in mind.
Well, absolutely. I think that being a dissident in America is as American as apple pie, and that we have to resist government attempts to paint all dissidents as on some kind of slippery slope towards paranoid, irrational, lunatic violence, which tends to be the rhetoric for anyone who's trying to effect change. We have to look at whether that change is being effected peacefully or violently, and we have to see who benefits and whether it increases equality or it decreases democracy.
Right on.
All right. Thanks for the call. Just near the beginning, I made reference to this to a recent report by the Southern Poverty Law Center about membership in patriot groups, and it's very striking that this brief version of the report that I've seen, they conclude by writing that anti-government ideology has been with the United States since its founding, and it's certain to remain a permanent fixture in our culture, something that you've certainly talked about here this morning.
Yeah.
They go on to say, the only question is precisely what form the anti-government extremist right will take in the decades to come. Do you have any thought about what form it might take in the decades to come?
Well, I can't be predictive. What I can argue is that since it's these right-wing populist movements have been around since before we were a country, or at least in their proto-format, and given the history of groups like the Klan, there are cycles of protest. That's the basic theme of sociology. These groups grow and they shrink. They spin off violent arms. That's just the nature of all dissidency. And we need to be wary of groups that target scapegoats and defend those scapegoats. But we also need to be wary of the government arguing that we need to give up our rights to fight dissident groups.
Hmm. What, in terms of law enforcement, how do we walk that line?
It's tough. I'm glad I'm not in law enforcement, so I don't have to make that decision. Basically, it's understanding that not all dissidents are ultimately controlled or heading towards criminal behavior. And the old social science of people like Lipset and Bell and Viereck, which basically came up with the phrases like extremists of the left and right and lunatic fringe and my personal favorite, wing nuts, that sociology and political science has been largely discredited. People don't join dissident movements because they're pathological. They join them because they're angry about something. And I think law enforcement needs to get away from the idea that dissidents are pathological and get towards the idea that these are angry people that have a right to dissent, and then determine how best to stop those people who have violent intent.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
These are all great questions.
We appreciate it. Chip Berlay, Senior Analyst at Political Research Associates. Again, they do have a website. If you'd like to learn more about this organization and read some of the reports and articles that are available there, you can do that. Also, you can look for his book, Right-Wing Populism in America, Too Close for Comfort, that he co-authored with Matthew Lyons, published last year by Guilford Publications.